Will the tight labor market fuel inflation? And now that you mention it, what is a tight labor market? From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, today is Tuesday, September 7th, and this is In the Moment. The United States Bureau of Labor Statistics' latest report didn't deliver the news economists had hoped for. Joe Santos is a professor of economics at South Dakota State University, and he explains what the report means and how it could fuel inflation in the latest morning macro. But first, we touch base with Dr. Shankar Kura, Vice President of Medical Affairs for Monument Health, for the latest COVID-19 update. And later, we look to the night sky on the Mickelson Star Trail. We're broadcasting live today from the Kirby Family Studio inside SDPB's Sioux Falls studio. I'm Jackie Hendry, in today for Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first.
With SDPB News, I'm Kyle Ireland. September is Suicide Prevention Month in South Dakota. Suicide is the 10th leading cause of death in the state, and data from earlier this year suggests suicides are on the rise. At the end of August, a small group of volunteers based in Rapid City responded to 5 suicides in less than 2 weeks. SDPB's Jackie Hendry has more.
The Front Porch Coalition is a suicide prevention nonprofit that serves Pennington, Meade, and parts of Lawrence County. One of its services is the Loss Team, volunteers with their own experiences of suicide loss who comfort families immediately after a death by suicide. Responding quickly after a death by suicide is prevention work. Losing a friend or family member to suicide is itself a risk factor.
If you lose a loved one to suicide, you are 10 times more likely to struggle with suicidal ideation yourself.
Bridget Swear is the Director of Outreach and Communication for the Front Porch Coalition. She's also one of 4 members of the Loss Team. Swear says the team remains connected with grieving loved ones up to a year after the death.
There's a lot that happens in that first year for families. They're grieving the loss. There's anniversaries that come up, holidays. Those are very difficult times. And because suicide grief is a very complex grief with complex emotions, we want to make sure that they know that there is a support system available for them.
Normally, members take time off from the team if they have responded to multiple calls in a short amount of time. Swear says the small team has made that impossible.
When we've had, 5 suicides in under 2 weeks, it's really hard to kind of regain your composure.
Swear says more Loss Team members is a big need, but she also encourages people to take the time they need to heal from their own loss before volunteering. Those interested can contact the Front Porch Coalition by email. And anyone interested in seeking help for their own suicidal thoughts can call the national hotline or the statewide 211 helpline. Provisional data from the Department of Health shows 88 people died by suicide in South Dakota in the first 5 months of this year. That's compared to 59 deaths in the same time period last year. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Jackie Hendry.
South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem says the National Guard troops that she deployed to the U.S. border with Mexico will return later this month. The Republican governor deployed 48 National Guard troops to Texas in July. The deployment came in response to a request from Texas and Arizona to send law enforcement officers under an agreement between states to assist during emergencies. Noem says the soldiers encountered more than 6,000 people crossing the border in the month and a half that they were stationed there. U.S. authorities stopped migrants about 210,000 times at the border in July, the highest number in more than 20 years. The South Dakota Department of Public Safety says 2 South Dakota tribes are getting funding for their 911 call centers. A total of $132,669 is being given to the tribes. The Ogallala Sioux Tribe received $86,240 from the state's 911 coordination board in March. Last week, the board approved another $46,449 in funding for the Cheyenne River Tribal Department of Public Safety. State officials say the one-time funding is available to 911 centers statewide for equipment upgrades and other infrastructure needs. For more news from SDPB, visit our website at sdpb.org/news. For listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Kyle Ireland.
and I'm Jackie Hendry in today for Lori Walsh. The most recent surge in COVID-19 cases continues in our state, and schools around the state are reconsidering their mask policies, including the Rapid City Area School District. Dr. Shankar Kura is Vice President of Medical Affairs at Monument Health, and he joins us again for an update. Dr. Kura, welcome back to In the Moment. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Jackie. A pleasure to be here.
So let's take a quick look at some of the most recent COVID-19 numbers, and the data, because of the long weekend, is a little different than usual. The numbers I'm about to share reflect data through 1 p.m. on Friday. So we're looking at around 453 new COVID cases around the state, over 6,000 active cases, and 213 people currently hospitalized. Again, that's as of 1 p.m. on Friday. So, Dr. Kura, we've seen West River seems to be driving a lot of this surge, at least in the earlier phases of it a few weeks ago. Give us an update from Monument Health.
Yes, Jackie. Unfortunately, we're seeing a pretty significant increase in West River when you look at the state as a whole. And at Monument Health, we're also kind of similar numbers we're seeing. And the good news, if there's any bright spot, is here, maybe there's a small slowing down. We cannot call it a trend yet. Mm. We'll need another couple of weeks. But the cases are there, and we're seeing a lot of those folks are younger and sicker.
Mm. And what proportion of those folks who are being hospitalized are unvaccinated?
Yeah, so what we have, I can give you a number, a snapshot, if you will. On September 1st, 2021, we had a total in-house of 79 all COVID cases, of which 64 were unvaccinated. So that's 81% of people unvaccinated. That kind of goes well with what we know the efficacy of the vaccine is. Mm. You know, we are saying if you look at the vaccine so far approved or authorized for use, 81% is an excellent rate that, you know, you're protected, very unlikely to be admitted if you're vaccinated. The other thing I would like to point out is our ICU admissions. Mm. So among those, we have a total of 24 in the intensive care unit requiring ventilator support, some of them. But of the 24 in the ICU, 23 are unvaccinated. So
wow.
If you're unvaccinated, you're very likely to require critical intensive care, and probably, you know, your long-term prognosis is poor.
Interesting. We know there are multiple vaccine clinics occurring West River and across the state. Dr. Kura, I'm curious, when we talk about vaccine mandates in certain businesses and industries around the state, as this trend seems to continue, we know Sanford has required staff to receive the COVID vaccine. Are you able to share with us how that decision is being made at Monument as to whether or not to require vaccines for your staff?
Yes, we have a team of clinical experts and operational leaders. We have been discussing this ever since the FDA gave their approval to the Pfizer vaccine, and we know that Moderna is now applied for it, and we should hear from the FDA about that vaccine as well. So, as you all know, there are three vaccines that have received emergency use authorization, one of which now is approved, and we've been wanting to make sure we take that into consideration before we make any decision. And so that those are weekly and now daily meetings. Mm. And we will soon arrive at a appropriate plan and how to implement and what's the best way going forward.
Interesting. I know other hospital systems have also talked with us a little bit about staffing concerns that have frankly not been alleviated over the last year or so for a variety of different reasons. Can you tell us a little bit where you stand with staffing at Monument as we see this surge?
Yeah, that's our biggest challenge. Not easy for anyone. We're on, calls with peers across the country and the state. And this is a known issue at all levels and all kinds of staffing, not just doctors, nurses, technicians, but everyone, housekeeping, every single member of our team. is stressed in terms of being here every day and then having to face the community-wide spread and making sure they're safe, their families are safe. So this is putting a lot of strain, and then the labor pool is also only limited. So adding all that, those challenges remain. We have been fortunate that our entire Monument Health staff has been willing to stay the course and be with us, and we've continued to protect them as best we can and continue to be mindful of that. But that is a absolute challenge, and that's kind of one of our big decision points for doing anything.
Right. And I wonder how much of a limited staffing pool plays into a decision about whether or not to require vaccines. Is there a connection there?
Yeah, there is, though our concern, as always, as a health system, is to look at it from a community health standpoint, population, and making sure that our decisions are, protecting our community, protecting our patients, protecting those in the front lines that are giving care daily. And this is a complex situation. The logistics always involve staffing considerations. But like I said, the priority still is how do we protect and make sure we do the right thing from a health perspective.
Right. Speaking of protecting community, doing the right thing, the mask debate seems to be rearing its head yet again as we see the surge continuing, especially with back-to-school season. And we're seeing schools around the state consider masking policies, among other things. Even Rapid City Area School District is considering that this evening. I'm curious, has Monument played a role in consulting area school boards most recently? Have you had outreach from the schools?
Absolutely. We're always in communication weekly, sometimes daily, and our advice always has been based on CDC guidelines. And if you can see clearly, any time you have a community rise in cases, what we call widespread community disease burden, like we're seeing right now in the West River counties, the CDC's guideline is very straightforward. It says that anyone 2 and above should be masked, and anyone who's eligible to vaccinate 12 and above should get vaccinated. So that's kind of, we follow the science, the evidence, and of course the CDC's recommendations, because those guidelines are made by experts in the field, and we follow those.
Right. So we'll say that again. Anyone 2 and above should be wearing a mask. And if you're eligible to get vaccinated, you should get vaccinated. Dr. Kuro, we've asked this question again. We're gonna before, and we're gonna ask it again, just to really clarify for folks who say, "Well, I got a vaccine largely because I didn't want to wear my mask anymore." Can you explain just one more time for folks why, even if you are fully vaccinated, you should also continue wearing a mask?
Absolutely. So again, the CDC guidelines are very straightforward in this. If you have a community-wide outbreak, in other words, large numbers of cases being reported, the correct thing to do, even if you're vaccinated, to wear the mask. Now, we know that breakthrough infections range anywhere from 0.5% to 1.5%. So in other words, if you're vaccinated, you could still contract the disease, the Delta variant. The good news is you won't be, probably critically ill or die. That is less than very low, less than 1%. Mm. But the reason we recommend you mask in crowded places, indoors, poorly ventilated spaces, even if you're vaccinated, is to reduce that risk. And also there is a small chance, again, of transmitting the disease as well. So you are doing a great favor to the community, to the health system, to other folks who are probably not as fortunate to be protected by several reasons, immune reasons and other reasons.
Right. Dr. Shankar Kura is Vice President of Medical Affairs at Monument Health, giving us an update on COVID-19 in the state. Dr. Kura, as always, thank you very much for your time and your knowledge.
My pleasure, Jackie. Thank you.
Coming up after a break, SDPB's Ariel Zients gives us the history of a unique bridge that connects Wind Cave National Park with Custer State Park. You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Health reporting on SDPB is supported by Monument Health.
Tenor saxophonist Sonny Rollins is a restless artist who famously retreated from the scene a few times to practice and work on his music. Despite all his tremendous accomplishments, when illness forced him to stop playing, he lamented that he had not achieved everything he wanted to artistically. Rollins is celebrating his 91st birthday and will mark the occasion with a few of his classic recordings on the Tuesday edition of Jazz Nightly. I'm Carl Gerke, and you can join me at 8 Central, 7 Mountain.
Program funding by Arts South Dakota, encouraging the development of artistic talent and appreciation in all South Dakotans. Advancing the arts through education, service, and advocacy. More at artssouthdakota.org.
South Dakota Public Broadcasting is proud to announce the recipients of two National Edward R. Murrow Awards. Lee Strubinger is recognized for excellence in writing.
And they got the news they hoped they wouldn't.
And she was crying. And she said, Mom, he has COVID.
And Seth Tupper for investigative reporting.
Somewhat of a head scratcher to think about, well, how did it get there?
The only possible culprit was the fireworks.
Quality reporting about issues that matter are what you get here at SDPB.
Program funding by SDN Communications. As our 50,000-mile fiber network expands across rural South Dakota, new business opportunities grow right along with it. More at SDNCommunications.com.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Jackie Hendry, in today for Lori Walsh. A historic arched bridge in Wind Cave National Park is shut down for 2 months of renovations. The 92-year-old bridge rises out of a rocky canyon to connect the national park with Custer State Park. SDPB's Ariel Zients has more on the history and future of Beaver Creek Bridge.
Wind Cave National Park shares a northern border with Custer State Park in the Black Hills. Visitors can see bison and pronghorn while traversing scenery ranging from flat prairies to forested mountains and canyons. The Beaver Creek Bridge provides an essential link between the parks across a steep canyon.
What's cool about this bridge? It's such a secluded spot.
Tom Farrell is chief of interpretation at Wind Cave National Park. He stands at a lookout on Highway 87 that offers a stunning view. Across a valley, white arches and columns rise from the rocky, forested edges of a canyon. The bridge spans more than 200 feet across and more than 100 feet above Beaver Creek.
You can come out and watch it. You can hear Beaver Creek in the distance below it. And just this white expanse of concrete that's aged out over the years. It just stands there as a silent sentinel between these two canyons, making sure people can cross the canyon.
Farrell says visitors will miss out on the bridge if they don't stop at the vista or explore around the structure itself.
It's easy to overlook because you just drive over it, but if you stop and pause and take a look, you realize this is a special place. And you spend a little bit of time here just listening to the river underneath and watching the bridge, you kind of get the impression what an interesting, special, unique place this is.
Highway 87 is closed from the lookout to the intersection north of Rankin Ridge until crews finish renovating the bridge in mid-October. Inspectors with the National Bridge Inventory have been recommending rehabilitation since 2010, when they noticed general deterioration. The bridge is rated fair rather than poor or good.
We're doing some routine maintenance on the bridge. Just the fact that it's 92 years old and you want to just keep up on it.
Beaver Creek Bridge isn't as well known as the granite tunnels on Needles Highway or the wooden pigtail bridges along Iron Mountain Road. But all were built in the same era under the vision and aesthetic philosophy of a former governor and U.S. senator.
Senator Peter Norbeck was instrumental in getting this bridge built. He was a person behind Custer State Park, and he helped design the roadways, the scenic drives through the Black Hills. It just blends into the scenery. I mean, it's just part of the scenery. And that's what Senator Norbeck wanted. He wanted something like this that wasn't obtrusive, that just blended in.
Farrell hikes down a steep, slippery slope to look up at the Beaver Creek Bridge. He says it could have been built at a narrower, more convenient part of the canyon. But the planners chose to cross at this spot, which was more complex but scenic. Crews built the bridge in 1929 with an average of 20 workers a day. It was completed after 154 days.
They had to do the concrete in one continual pour because you couldn't get from one side to the other side. They had to have two mixing plants on either side. and they had to do it into the night. And so they brought in these gas lanterns that you'd use in a circus back in the day. And just the commotion and the shadows and working at night on the bridge, that would have been a fun night, just have sat in the corner and kind of watched this happen.
Beaver Creek Bridge is the longest and most complex concrete bridge in South Dakota. And it's the only open spandrel concrete arch bridge in the state. That means the roadway and arch are connected with columns rather than solid concrete. The bridge was added to the National Register of Historic Places due to its architectural uniqueness and historical connection to Senator Norbeck and recreation in the Black Hills. The National Park Service is paying nearly $500,000 for renovations to Beaver Creek and another nearby bridge. A Rapid City company is doing the work. The renovations will allow visitors to have an easy and scenic journey between Wind Cave and Custer State Park for years to come. For now, visitors traveling between the two sites can take a detour through the town of Custer. I'm SDPB's Ariel Zients at Wind Cave National Park.
To access our stories online, visit our website at sdpb.org/news. Coming up after a break, Joe Santos explains what we can expect from a tight labor market in the latest Morning Macro. You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
South Dakota Home Garden offers more opportunities for you to learn during South Dakota's short but sweet growing season. SDPB makes it easier by sharing gardening advice across all our platforms. Join us on TV, radio, and online at sdpb.org/sdhomegarden to keep your gardening ideas fresh this season.
Program funding is provided by First Dakota National Bank. Every big endeavor begins somewhere, with someone who has a dream and the passion to make it happen first. FirstDakota.com/first.
Hi, this is Steve Inskeep with NPR, here to thank sustaining members of this station. Public Radio is here for you every day, no matter what. And when you give automatically every month, you continually show that you're here for us and for this community. Thank you so much for your support.
Monthly sustaining supporters form a strong foundation for SDPB. Sustaining donations are ones SDPB can count on to fund programs you love. Thank you.
Program funding by the Museum and the South Dakota Cultural Heritage Center in Pierre, now offering free admission to South Dakota residents and children from everywhere. Coronavirus protections in place. Learn more by calling the Cultural Heritage Center or visit history.sd.gov.
Business and Community Development reporting on SDPB is supported by SDN Communications. Learn more at sdncommunications.com.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Jackie Hendry, in today for Lori Walsh. You've probably seen the signs around your town asking for patience as businesses experience short staffing. Well, what seems to be driving that tight labor market, and what can we expect? Those are the questions we tackle in today's Morning Macro with Joe Santos. He's a professor of economics and Dykehouse Scholar of Money, Banking, and Regulation at South Dakota State University. You can read his blogs at schooled.blog.com. Joe Santos, welcome back to In the Moment. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Jackie.
So the title of this latest blog post is Wagering on Recovery. You start with the United States Bureau of Labor Statistics report on September 3rd that the number of employed persons grew by 235,000 in the nation, while the nation's unemployment rate fell to 5.2%. And in theory, in my brain, I think, you know, employed people up, unemployment down, that's good news, but apparently not. Explain to us why.
Sure. So, we economists can always see the glass half empty. So the rub here is that 235,000 additional names on payrolls is one way to think about this employment measure, was at least too low by about a third. So economists and other observers were expecting something on the order of 750,000 to 1 million new jobs or payrolls. And what this signals, I think, to most economists is that the labor market has still scarred from the pandemic. So long-ish story short, and one that I bet listeners are fairly familiar with by now, is that the pandemic had this sort of supply and demand effect on labor. So the demand for labor contracted dramatically, as did the supply of labor. And so we had, you know, a lot of nothing going on during lockdown. And then since then, the demand for labor seems to have picked up again. So if we look at different measures like the number of unemployed people compared to the number of job openings and so on, it seems like there's insufficient supply of workers. And so when this report came out, and, you know, as you said, it read 235,000 as opposed to, I don't know, 800,000, that just seemed to suggest even more that, if you will, the supply side of this equation was not where we would like to see it.
Hmm. And you don't really touch on this too much in the blog, but I think the first question that comes to a lot of people's minds is, well, why is that? I hear a lot of people talk about, blaming the government for coddling people, for instance, or you see reports about people deciding the job that they had before the pandemic they don't want to go back to, so they're going on to something else. Where do we see kind of the why for this?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and one that we have, you know, talked about a bit on other episodes, where it seems that some of this is, as you've just described, a matter of search. Either individuals are staying away from certain positions they might otherwise take just because of concerns that are directly related to the virus. Others may be reevaluating their opportunities in light of this sort of staying at home period, and they can sort of think about their preferences and their skills and so on. Others, sadly, may be a bit more detached from employment than they realize, because the economy is dynamic, it has changed, skills, demands for certain skills have changed, and maybe even the geography, the location of those jobs has changed. So there's all that. And then you have, as you also suggested in your question, this kind of exiting from the labor force, which I think of as something slightly different, where individuals just aren't, if you will, in the game any longer. And some of this may be at least indirectly related to the pandemic. You know, I think of things like accelerated retirement, for example. So there's a persistence to that, right? Because someone decided to retire sooner than they would have, and they have no intention of returning in any case. So it's a really good question you've asked. There's a lot going on, we suspect, but the sort of sum total of it is that there are these gaps in employment right now. Gaps, I mean, you know, think about where the U.S. economy or the South Dakota economy was in February 2020 before all went very differently compared to where it is now. And there just aren't the number of persons employed that there were before. And, you know, all else equal, you would think that gap would have to be filled in order for the labor market to sort of reestablish something we're familiar with as normal.
Right. So then with this gap persisting, what is the next step for employers?
Yeah, so this is, you know, what's up, and the answer is probably wages, because we would imagine would happen just based on microeconomic theory is, if you do have this essentially excess demand for labor, you would expect that labor markets would bid up the price of labor services, what we, of course, affectionately think of as wages and salaries. So that's what the theory would tell us. If, as you said, this is going to be a persistent gap, you're going to have to attract individuals back into the labor force, and in particular back into that status we call employed, by paying them more. So if this does persist, we expect that is what we would see. And in fact, if we look at some of the data for the U.S. economy, there is some evidence, something economists affectionately call an employment cost index, which tries to capture this effect on wages at a very aggregate level. Not the easiest thing to do, but there is evidence from that index that wage pressures are rising, and maybe more interestingly, and even more consistent with theory, that those pressures may be greatest where the gaps are largest.
Where do we see those largest gaps? Is this an industry line that we're seeing this?
Sure. So if we break this up by industries, and I do a bit of this on that blog, and folks are welcome to take a look at this, it's sort of interesting. You know, leisure and hospitality is the one I think everybody thinks of when they think of where the greatest gap occurred at the instant of lockdown, and indeed where the greatest gap remains. So right now, just some numbers to play with, the U.S. economy, about 12% of a gap in the number of persons who were in leisure and hospitality, that percent that's still missing. And sure enough, if you look at this employment cost index for leisure and hospitality, there is quite a bit of wage pressure there. Likewise, in those industries where we don't see very large employment gaps, it's not a perfect relationship, but in those industries, there tends to be less wage pressure. Again, just looking at these sort of ballpark aggregate measures of wage pressures, they seem to be greater where the gaps are largest.
Interesting. And again, that blog is called schooled.blog.com, where you can be following along with us and catch up on past entries from Joe Santos. Joe, I'm thinking about this employment cost index. Do we have that level of information at the state level?
Great question. So there are measures of wages, earnings, salaries, and so on for the state level. One, there are problems with some of them. Problems, given the question we're asking, they're not fundamentally problematic. But if folks leave positions, for example, the total amount of salaries and wages fall, and we're trying to just get at the wage rate, you know, what do I make in an hour? Mm-hmm. So there is an employment cost index for the what's called the Midwest Census region. And of course, we're in that region. And if we look at that measure, again, the message broadly, it's a noisy data set, but broadly, the message seems to be that wages are on the rise in what we would characterize, or the U.S. government would characterize, as the Midwest Census region. So, again, folks can take a look at this one on the blog. It's not as unambiguous, but the jagged line is slowly going up and to the right. And so there do seem to be wage pressures there as well. I should say in almost all these cases, with the exception of the leisure and hospitality example, most of these percentage gains year over year, just so listeners have a sense, we're not talking about 15 and 20% increase in wages. We're talking about threes and fours, and in the case of leisure and hospitality, maybe six. Mm. And for that Midwest census region, maybe 3.4, 3.2. So that's the sort of magnitudes that we're talking about here when we say increased wage pressures. Nevertheless, they are those pressures are greater than they were, say, in, you know, 2018 or something.
Interesting. I'm curious about your take on this, and I'll kind of talk my way out of it and see where you bring me. So I'm thinking about, you know, U.S. unemployment as of September 3rd is 5.2%, which was a drop from where we were before. Meanwhile, South Dakota unemployment in July came in about 2.7%, much lower than the national unemployment rate. Which has been a frequent, almost bragging point in South Dakota, mm-hmm. of a very low unemployment rate. And yet, you know, I'm still seeing the same, you know, signage that a lot of people around the country are talking about, in especially, you know, service industry related jobs and things, the sign on the door that says, please be patient, we're experiencing low staff like everyone else and that sort of thing. Connect that dot for me. Are we, despite this low unemployment rate, which has always been a good thing, we're still seeing this gap?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And we are still seeing the gap. I should say the gap for South Dakota, again, from, say, 25,000 feet instead of 50, but just looking down at the entire state, mm-hmm. the gap is far less. So, again, just some ballpark numbers. For the United States, the gap's about 4 or 5% of the number of people who were working just before lockdown. For South Dakota, it's about 1% of the mm-hmm. number of people who were working before lockdown. So the gap is closing. And so the sort of conundrum you very rightly raised is sort of going away a bit because the gap isn't as large as it once was. But there's no doubt, the unemployment rate is very, very low. But nevertheless, as your question suggests, it seems that, you know, we don't quite know the meaning of a tight labor market yet because it seems that there's so much greater demand for employment in South Dakota. And that's just an interesting sectoral shift that sort of found its way into our state. And it suggests that the unemployment rate could go lower because, you know, if we get folks back into the labor force and the way they come in is they get a job, the unemployment percentage would necessarily fall. So there seems to be room to go down. But you're right. If you look at a time series of this over, you know, decades, 2.7% is already quite low, but as I say, I think this speaks to what is a tight and an increasingly tight labor market in the region.
Interesting. So tight labor market means we get into this sort of bidding war for employees. You might see that 3%-ish and up wage increase to sure. entice folks back. Certainly that doesn't come without its costs, forgive mm-hmm. the pun. So what do we expect to happen from there?
Sure. So, from the employer's perspective, of course, these are additional costs, as you point out. So there's one, group of, say, members of the audience right now who may not be loving the idea of hearing about wage pressures. But, you know, we're economists, so everyone will get bad news here. those who are earning the higher wages may be sort of, you know, celebrating this bit of news. But, of course, while we're talking about all this, almost literally in real time, there are what we call aggregate price pressures all around us. That is, the prices of the goods and services that we're going to purchase with those paychecks. Mm-hmm. Those prices are also rising. And, of course, we're referring here to inflation. So while these wage pressures have sort of played themselves out, so too has inflation at higher rates than we've seen before. So again, some numbers really make this concrete. Inflation is running year over year, and based on one index, there are many, but based on one index, I'd say the inflation rate's running year over year about 5%. So many of the wage pressure growth rates you and I have been throwing around, numbers like threes and fours and so on, mm-hmm. Have one thing in common. They're all less than five. So in terms of purchasing power, what you can buy with the money as opposed to the amount of money you got, in terms of purchasing power, on average anyway, it's not clear that workers are being rewarded with greater purchasing power at the moment because, again, inflation is at the same time eroding the gains that are being made from the employees' perspective, the gains that are being made by higher wages.
Interesting. So that kind of answers my next question, which was, well, if my pay's going up, maybe inflation evens it out somehow, but it's that nasty percentage game you point out.
That's right. And so it really is a percentage gain, and it works to the disadvantage of workers in that case. I mean, unambiguously, you'd rather a pay raise without inflation than a pay raise with. That's right.
Mm-hmm. Is there any kind of comparable tight labor market moment that we can look back on to see how it kind of shook itself out that would bring us close to what we can expect from what we're seeing now?
That's a good question. Yeah, I mean, the labor markets, when the economy begins to expand, it's not entirely unreasonable to expect tighter labor markets. And that's in part because labor force participation rates do tend to drop during recession. So you see these drops, folks exit the labor force, and, you know, it turns out not to be permanent. They're brought back in. We saw this toward the end of that very long expansion that ended, unfortunately, with the pandemic, where labor force participation seemed to always surprise us. There was always someone else ready to work as the economy continued to expand. And so that tightness, if you will, worked itself out. I will say there's something very interesting about this recession. It was, after all, a recession. And that is the labor force participation rate and other sorts of measures of, you know, just the number of people ready, able to work relative to the population and so forth. That rate dropped more for women this time around than it did for men. That's not typical. Usually, female participation rates act as a sort of stabilizer to household income because the participation rates tend not to fall. In this case, it's the reverse. And again, I think, you know, it's sores of obvious given our culture and sort of social mores and so on, what's going on here with child care and care for elderly in the face of a pandemic. These jobs, these roles are falling disproportionately to women. And so that, it's an excellent question, that is different. And that may have a persistence that we're not really familiar with. You know, we're not exactly sure how that works itself out, absent a complete annihilation of the virus in every form, every variant, where we're back to normal. Other than that, you know, we're not sure if that participation rate rebounds. We've not been able to observe that. So sort of answering your question in an opposite way, here's what is very different and troubling because it means that that tightness may persist.
Interesting. Again, that was today's Morning Macro. You can read along with us and catch up on past entries at schooled.blog.com. That's schooled, D-O-T-B-L-O-G.com. Joe Santos, thanks as always for joining us today. Much appreciated.
Thank you, Jackie.
Now let's take a moment for South Dakota history. Harding County celebrates its anniversary on Labor Day weekend. It's officially 112 years old, but was established in 1881 and later became part of Butte County. Harding County was separated again in 1909. It's in the northwest corner of South Dakota, bordering Montana and North Dakota. The county is named for John Harding. He started out as a wool manufacturer and was later a dry goods merchant in Deadwood. He became a postmaster and later served as Speaker of the House for the Dakota Territory in 1881 when the original county was platted. Harding County is the fourth largest county by land area, but with a total population of just over 1,300 people. The two main communities are Buffalo and Camp Crook. In 2009, Centennial Park was created to celebrate the county's 100th anniversary. The park recognizes the history and heritage of Harding County and the people who settled and remained there. Centennial Park in Buffalo includes a statue of legendary bucking horse Tipperary to represent the rich history of rodeo. Tipperary was considered one of the greatest bucking horses of all time, bucking off 91 cowboys while having only two qualified rides on him. A windmill and water pump honor the farmers and ranchers who homesteaded the area. And a painted buffalo portrays the Bison Society and the Lakota Warrior Society for protecting the family and tribe, and it honors veterans and warriors, as well as the buffalo culture. Harding County, South Dakota, marking its 112th anniversary this past weekend. Production help thanks to Dr. Brad Tennant, Professor of History at Presentation College. Coming up after a break, a look at darker skies on Mickelson Star Trail Night. You're in the moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
As the news gets more complex and changes through the day, you need more than just a quick headline check. Here and Now keeps you connected to your world between Morning Edition and All Things Considered, as the news and the people shaping it are changing in real time. I'm Robin Young. Follow along on Here and Now, NPR News weekday afternoons. This afternoon, beginning at 1 Central, Noon Mountain, on SDPB Radio.
Program funding is provided by the South Dakota Humanities Council, celebrating literature, promoting civil conversation, and telling the stories that define our state. Learn more at sdhumanities.org.
20 years ago, the September 11th terrorist attacks changed the world. I'm reporter Jim O'Grady, and I'm going to revisit the evidence and question the people at the center of the story.
It's always easy in hindsight to say it's a big mistake.
Let's penetrate his cell.
And I promised him revenge.
Blind Spot, The Road to 9/11, an investigative special from the History Channel and WNYC Studios.
Listen Friday, September 10th at 1 Central, Noon Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding with your support and Co-op Architecture, an architecture firm of sound mind, strong wind, and able limb, with offices in the Hub City, the Queen City, and the Rapid City. co-oparch.com.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Jackie Hendry, in today for Lori Walsh. On Friday, the South Dakota chapter of the International Dark Sky Association is hosting the Mickelson Star Trail Night in the Black Hills. Diane Knutson is president of the International Dark Sky Association Board of Directors and also founded the IDA chapter of South Dakota. Diane joins us now with more. Diane, welcome to In the Moment. Thanks for being here today.
Thanks, Jackie. Pleasure to be with you.
So before we get to the event coming up this week, I wonder if you'd tell us a little bit about the International Dark Sky Association and why you wanted to bring a chapter here to South Dakota.
Yeah, the International Dark Sky Association, IDA, protects the night for a variety of reasons of the impact of light as a pollutant. So we look at areas that can help by reducing their light at home, businesses, cities, and IDA South Dakota is leading the efforts in this state to be able to do that.
Mm-hmm. And why is this important to you personally?
Yeah, I used to be a ranger at Wind Cave National Park, and we could see the sky glow of Rapid City hour away, and the songbirds would sing to what they thought was the rising sun, but it was actually the sky glow of the city. And there's all kinds of impacts that it makes on wildlife and humans and the circadian rhythm of night and day. And a lot of people aren't aware that that's an issue, and trying to bring more education and awareness to that, because it's a really relatively easy problem to solve.
Interesting. Tell us then about this Michelson Star Trail Night. What all does this event entail?
Yeah, it's on Friday on the 10th, September 10th, from 5 to 10 p.m. We're going to meet at the Rochford Trailhead by the fire station, and it's rain or shine or cloudy or clear. We will have the event because we've got a variety of programs, indoor and outdoor, where we have featured presenters coming. One is Avila Owens from the Tufts University speaking on bioluminescent creatures featuring fireflies. Another is Lakota Star Knowledge with Craig Howe with Cairns, which is the Center for American Indian Research and Native Studies. Then we've got a variety of collaborators with the Black Hills Parks and Forests Association, the NASA Night Sky Network and Solar System Ambassadors, the Badlands Conservancy, and the Game Fish and Parks and the Raptor Center, all helping to put on a variety of programs along with viewing opportunities through telescopes.
Interesting. Is this an event that has taken place before?
Well, this is our sixth annual event. We used to be held in downtown Rapid City. This one, we are going along the Michelson Star Trail to get a little bit more remote access where we have a better view of things in the night sky, a better opportunity to experience a natural night void of as much light pollution as mm-hmm. present when you're within a city.
Right. So let's talk a little bit about what we mean when we say light pollution, because I think a lot of people hear pollution, they think, you know, something that's, you know, immediately poisoning or like a gas almost. but talk to us about light pollution. What does that mean?
Yeah, a lot of light pollution presents itself in a form of glare, which is what makes it hard to see. So if you have a bulb fixture that is emitting light, instead of having it directed downward, it might be going horizontally, it might be going up vertically in the sky, or bouncing off a reflective surface. Even snow or humidity can do that. Mm. That creates this glow that, when you have a lot of these sources, creates that sky glow cumulatively that can be seen for miles and miles.
Interesting. And you said earlier it's a relatively easy problem to solve. How could the average person consider their own almost light pollution footprint?
Yeah, there's a lighting assessment tool that people can use. And you get this sheet, it's friendly lighting practices, where you assess the lighting that you control. It might be at home, it might be at a business, and you can assess where the light sources are coming from, what is it illuminating, and what color temperature it is, if it's on all the time or if it's on a motion sensor. And then you record those findings, and the assessment will take you through solutions to eliminate it or reduce that amount of light pollution.
Interesting. And where, again, can people find that assessment?
Darksky.org. You can pull up the home lighting assessment.
Right.
And you can even certify your home as night sky friendly.
Mm-hmm. Are there any dark sky events anticipated for East River, or is the problem almost too large with the larger population centers here?
It would be something to consider. We would love to be able to bring an event more on the east side of the state. That is one consideration, because there is so much light pollution that travels. It's hard to get to a place that has natural night skies without driving several hours away. Mm-hmm. It's something that has been done and can be done again. We've had events at the outdoor campus and Gooder State Park. So as long as we've got hosts willing to put on a program and presenters available, that's something up for consideration.
Right. And again, there's several programs and speakers at this event coming up on Friday. Diane, what do you hope people take away from this event coming up?
That they can consider light as a pollutant and that they can resolve it. I think of adults today that might be the last generation to experience a night firsthand with of natural conditions, and that what if children today only experience is of the night is through nursery rhymes and fairy tales. Mm. So if we can offer that natural night environment and continue that for generations to come, of how much benefit that would be.
Diane Knutson is president of the International Dark Sky Association Board of Directors and also founded the IDA chapter of South Dakota, joining us to share details about the Mickelson Star Trail Night coming up this Friday. Diane, thanks again for your time. Much appreciated.
Thanks, Jackie.
Tashina Redhawk is this year's South Dakota High School Rodeo Queen. She went on to compete for the national title this summer, receiving first place in personality and sixth overall. Redhawk has been competing in rodeo events since she was just 4 years old. SDPB's Laura Johnson has her story.
One of Tashina Redhawk's earliest experiences on a horse was barrel racing. As a young girl, one day she hopped on the back of a white Arabian.
She was fast and she wanted to run like crazy. And I was this little girl who had my really protective dad had me on big slow horses. So I had this little fast horse that I had to get on, and that built my bravery to be able to get on different horses and barrel race.
Tashina is a Sichangu Lakota member. She grew up immersed in her culture and has an affinity for animals. Tashina and her father dress their horses in full Lakota regalia for events and parades. As the state's high school rodeo queen for the second time in 3 years, she travels around giving speeches as a rodeo ambassador. She incorporates the Lakota language when she introduces herself for rodeo queen events.
Mitakiapi, chante washte nape chuzapi, Tashina Redhawk imachiapi. All my relatives, I greet you with a warm-hearted handshake. My name's Tashina Redhawk. Then I'll say, good evening. I'm your South Dakota High School Rodeo Queen.
Tashina's father, Shane Redhawk, says his daughter goes out of her way to show kindness to everyone she can.
There'll be little girls, their eyes are about like that, and they're watching her walk by. And even though her mom or her other rodeo queen sisters, they're all walking right next to her, she'll stop and she'll reach back and she'll high-five them. And you see them jump off and get excited. I mean, to acknowledge all of the little ones like that and gives them hope. Maybe they're going to try for something in the future.
Tashina is a people person, but she has a passion to care for animals. She recalls a time when a young filly was stuck in a ball of barbed wire out in an isolated field.
So I didn't have service down here, so I had to run back up, grab my parents, run down there. And then my dad cut her off of the ball of barbed wire, and we put her up in the round pen. And I was the person to cut each strand of barbed wire off of her that was wrapped around her.
Tashina cleaned the wounds every day after school. She says on the ranch, she often has to care for injuries and pay attention to her animal's nutrition. Shane Redhawk says watching Tashina grow in her many roles in life is exciting. He has taught her Lakota traditions like singing and dancing.
She's not going to be a victim. Rather, she's an advocate. She's powerful. She has a voice just like my grandmother's. And when she sings in her Lakota way, man, my heart bursts. And you know, it's everything any dad could ever wish or dream for.
This will be Tashina's senior year at Todd County High School. She's taking dual credit courses online through South Dakota State University and Black Hills College. And she's seeking science courses through Syntegleshka University in Mission. Experiences as a ranch hand have piqued Tashina's interest in a veterinary science degree. Last year, she shadowed veterinarians and something unexpected happened.
Then all of a sudden, there was a dog that was losing oxygen on the table. And so the doctor says, turn off the gas machine, turn up the oxygen, and all of them were tied up in their animals and they were looking around, and the I can't remember which doctor it was at the time, but she went, can you turn that off and turn that up? That was the first time I got introduced to the surgery room because they needed help.
Tashina's experience with the veterinarians now has her monitoring animals during surgery. One of the vets was a role model for Tashina. The late Dr. Eric Jane's focus on nonprofit vet clinics has influenced Tashina's vision for her future. Veterinary science will let her continue to care for animals.
Being Lakota, horses are really important to us, and so is our animal nation. When we pray in all of our four directions, we address all four animal nations. And I believe that as much heart and helping that they put into us, I want to give that back to them.
This high school senior is also getting experience as an entrepreneur. When classes moved online during the pandemic, Tashina had some free time. Her father built a mobile coffee kiosk, and the business is teaching her new skills.
The coffee shop is really helping me with learning how to still have a fun aspect of life, but be able to be business and focused on something. So I think it's going to really prepare me for college, because I'm used to having to stock inventory, make sure staff employees there work it, but also do my homework at the same time.
Tashina works shifts at the shop and listens to her online lectures while she's serving coffee. Her tenacious personality feeds her many passions.
I want to be able to come back and give back to my tribe the amount of time that they've given to me at this clinic. But I would also like to travel and go to different vet places to experience, to know where I really want to be after school's all over.
Tashina plans to combine her love for small and large animals in her future studies to become a veterinarian. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Laura Johnson in Mission.
You can find that story from Laura Johnson and others on our website. That's sdpb.org/news.